Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 15 is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans, and Blue Apron. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Also, a reminder to listeners that the research, analysis, and opinions of the investigators, journalists, academics, and lawyers who you'll hear on this program about the circumstances surrounding Freddie Gray's killing are just that. Research, analysis, and opinions. We encourage listeners to reach their own conclusions and to vigorously debate our conclusions with us. Enjoy the program.
The grief that Baltimore exploded with after Freddie Gray died was real. But once things quieted down, another kind of battle was getting readied. Attorneys for both state and defense prepared to go to court. Now, bringing charges against the officers involved when, in many cases, officers aren't ever charged with anything when a citizen dies at their hands, well, that was a temporary balm for the wounds of the city. But the real healing would be in court, when those officers faced trial and possible convictions, and Freddie Gray was afforded some semblance of justice. At least, that's what many prayed for. Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm here with my colleagues, Dr. Marsha Chatlin, Justine Barron, and Amelia McDonald Perry. This week's episode is Trials.
If O.J. Simpson had never been charged and found not guilty of the murders of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown, and her friend Ron Goldman in 1997, the distinction of Los Angeles's trial of the century may have been given to the trial of Sergeant Stacy C. Coon, officers Lawrence M. Powell and Theodore J. Brazino, and former officer Timothy E. Wind, the three police officers who beat Rodney King while their sergeant encouraged them. In 1991, King was a 25-year-old taxi driver who struggled with addiction and was on parole when he was driving erratically on Interstate 210, the Foothills Freeway in the San Bernardino Valley. After a police chase that moved from the freeway into a residential neighborhood, the three officers successfully stopped King and proceeded to beat him with no less than 56 baton swings and unleashed the power of a taser to subdue him. Afterward, they hogtied King and put him in an ambulance. King was covered with bruises and sustained brain injuries that night. King was not charged with a crime. This was not the first time members of the Los Angeles Police Department subdued a suspect using what was described as, quote, power strokes, thereby raising concern about the use of force. And it wasn't the first or the last time that an African American was at the receiving end of such treatment in Los Angeles. By 1991, this was a way too familiar story. Yet this was before smartphones and GoPros and Twitter handles and Periscope accounts. So when George Holliday, a man living at the Lakeview Terrace apartment complex near where King was assaulted, grabbed a video camera and captured this moment, another instance of police force injected a new life into the narrative. Rodney King's beating would open up a national question about police abuse, about how far is too far, and what role race plays in the choices of police officers. But this time, people could see it.
Holliday tried to submit the video to the LAPD, but after receiving no substantive response, he brought it to a local television station, KTLA, which launched what was perhaps the very first viral video in the United States. After years of organizing against police violence, activists could easily believe that finally they had proof, tangible, visible evidence of what police brutality looks like. And in front of a reasonable jury, the video may recreate how it feels like to be subjected to a beating by not one, but three police officers. The Christopher Commission, a group charged with investigating the LAPD in 1991, praised Holliday's video, perhaps also believing that the visual could solve the police problem. Quote, "Our commission owes its existence to the George Holliday videotape. Whether there even would have been a Los Angeles Police Department investigation without the video is doubtful, since the efforts of King's brother Paul to file a complaint were frustrated, and the report of the involved officers was falsified. Even if there had been an investigation, our case-by-case review of the handling of over 700 complaints indicates, without the holiday videotape, the complaint may have been adjudged to be not sustained, because the officer's version conflicted with the account by King and his two passengers. But there was a video this time, and that would make all the difference, right?
Well, after 25 years of hindsight since the four officers were found not guilty of charges, ranging from assault with a deadly weapon to excessive use of force as a police officer, and then some post-beating breaches, including filing a false police report and serving as accessories after the fact, we've learned that VHS videotape, digital uploads, photographs, autopsy reports, and other pieces of evidence presented at the rare criminal trials of police officers rarely sways grand juries, petite juries, and the jury of public opinion. Police officers are hard to charge and even harder to prosecute. In the Rodney King case, there were forces far more powerful than any video. The defense was successful in moving the trial from Los Angeles and Los Angeles County to considerably more conservative Simi Valley in Ventura County, which was known as a residential area popular with former and current officers. The seating of a jury comprising 10 whites, 1 Latino, and 1 Asian in a case with a black victim also signaled that this may not be a sure thing. And then, the defense could benefit from the Supreme Court's Connor v. Graham ruling just 2 years earlier, which established the, quote, objectively reasonable standard in moments where officers use force. This basically means that whether the use of force is reasonable is determined by, quote, the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene, rather than with a 20/20 vision of hindsight. In my hindsight, the King case helps us understand where we are today. Police trials were rare then and are rare today, not because of poor evidence or victims and witnesses unwilling to pursue charges. It's because all of the structures and systems, attitudes and assumptions that surround every beating, every sexual assault, and every killing. At his trial, Sergeant Kuhn summed it up from his perspective. "Sometimes police work is brutal," he said. "That's just a fact of life." It's also a fact that between 2005 and 2015, although we know at least a few thousand people have been killed by police, approximately 13 police officers in the entire country over a decade have been charged with murder or manslaughter.
You might be shocked to learn that there is no official tracking system for the number of deaths that occur by the use of lethal force in the United States. Most states aren't required to report such statistics to anybody, but the FBI does collect data on something called, quote, justifiable homicide by law enforcement, which is defined as the killing of a felon by a peace, yes, a peace officer in the line of duty. Now, putting aside the questions of how reliable data that is self-reported by law enforcement is, and how someone can be considered a felon when they're killed before they face charges, trial, or conviction, this data set leaves out the obvious. Unjustifiable homicides of citizens at the hands of police officers. You know, like when someone gets shot while just sitting peacefully in their car with a baby in a back seat and a girlfriend videotaping, or someone has the life choked out of them by a team of officers for the offense of selling cigarettes. Stuff like that. Since there is virtually no government entity that even attempts to track this data, a few private organizations have begun attempting to, including the Washington Post, The Guardian, and an entity called Fatal Encounters. According to their research, since just the year 2000, between 12 to 15,000 people have been killed in the U.S. from police encounters. A study that looked at Baltimore City homicides by police officers on duty found that 31 people have been killed between just 2010 and 2014. We can assume dozens more have been killed before 2010. And while a Baltimore Sun investigation showed that the city has paid $5.7 million in court judgments and settlements in over 100 civil suits alleging police brutality since 2011, prior to the charges brought against the officers in the death of Freddie Gray, only five officers have ever faced charges in Baltimore City for killing a citizen. In other words, bringing criminal charges against police officers for the homicides committed by them on duty is exceedingly rare, not just in Baltimore, but across the U.S. And that's why it was a pretty big deal when the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, filed charges against six officers for the death of one person. Now, the charges against the officers ranged from voluntary and involuntary manslaughter to second-degree assault to misconduct in office to false imprisonment and reckless endangerment, but only one officer faced an actual murder charge, Officer Cesar Goodson Jr., the driver of the van transporting Freddie Gray. He was slapped with an offense the others didn't face, manslaughter by vehicle. And he also faced the most serious offense of all the officers, second-degree depraved heart murder. Now, let's start with the less serious offenses before getting to the murder charge, though, to be fair, every one of these offenses can result in hard prison time. Each officer was charged with misconduct in office, meaning they corruptly failed to perform a duty that was required by their office or position. It's a common law misdemeanor that doesn't have any required fine or minimum maximum prison time, but those who are convicted of it can face both, depending on the seriousness of the violation and the discretion of the sentencing judge. Four of the officers were charged with various counts of manslaughter, both criminal and negligent, and all of them felonies. Lieutenant Rice, who first made eye contact with Freddie Gray and was the highest-ranking officer on the scene. The driver of the van, Cesar Goodson. Sergeant Alicia White, the second-highest-ranking officer to come into contact with Freddie Gray, who allegedly didn't respond to him when he asked for medical assistance. Officer William Porter, who failed to buckle Freddie Gray up after meeting the van to check up on him. And Officers Nero and Miller, both of whom failed to give Freddie an inhaler when he asked for one. So what is manslaughter? It's not specifically defined by statute in Maryland, but it is understood through common law, meaning case law. In general, it's the unintentional killing of another person through gross negligence or criminal negligence, or in the commission of an unlawful act. Involuntary manslaughter, which is what the officers were charged with, applies in a situation where someone is killed accidentally without any premeditation or intention on the part of the defendant. Three of the officers were slapped with false imprisonment charges, Rice, Miller, and Nero. Why these three? Because false imprisonment involves the unlawful and intentional detention of a victim, and these are the three officers who were responsible for detaining Freddie. In other words, through this charge, the state's attorney's office is alleging there was no lawful reason to detain him at all. Interestingly enough, this charge was actually rejected by the grand jury. Now, the only other charge every single officer faced was second-degree assault, which is brought when a law enforcement officer, in the course of his duties, intentionally causes physical injury to a victim. The elements here are pretty straightforward: that the defendant did cause offensive physical contact or harm to the victim, and that it was done on purpose. It's an interesting charge leveled against Alicia White in particular, given she never laid a hand on Freddie. Goodson, you could argue, committed assault through the use of his vehicle, but I can't say I'm sure why White was charged with this, other than the propensity for prosecutors to generally throw as many charges as possible at a defendant for both strategic and tactical reasons. Now, we get to the sole murder charge in the case, against Officer Cesar Goodson. According to the state's attorney, it was the rough ride he gave Freddie that ultimately killed him, and so he was charged with what's known as depraved heart murder. Depraved heart murder may sound like some sordid deed out of a knife and dagger novel, but it is in fact the commonly used term in the law to describe the killing of someone that rises a level above criminal negligence. In a 1981 case, De Betancourt versus State, the Maryland Court of Special Appeals wrote about the depraved heart murder. Quote, "This highly blameworthy state of mind is not one of mere negligence. It is not merely one of even gross criminal negligence. It involves rather the deliberate perpetration of a knowingly dangerous act with reckless and wanton unconcern and indifference as to whether anyone is harmed or not. The common law treats such a state of mind as just as blameworthy, just as antisocial, and therefore just as truly murderous as the specific intents to kill and harm." In other words, the depraved heart murderer knows someone could die from their dangerous actions, and he or she doesn't care. This is a charge people are likely to face when the prosecution can't prove the specific intent to actually kill anybody, like you would show in a first-degree murder charge. And in Maryland, a defendant faces up to 30 years in prison if they're convicted of it. Of all the officers, Goodson was facing the harshest charge with the most severe penalty. But the state had the highest burden here, too. They had to prove that Goodson caused Freddie Gray's death that his conduct created a very high degree of risk to the life of the victim, and knowing this risk, Goodson acted with extreme disregard to Freddie Gray's life.
Support for Undisclosed comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. The mortgage experience wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated, and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in seconds. Based on your income, assets, and credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and find the one that's just right for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply. Understand fully. Mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/undisclosed. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Marilyn Mosby was on the job as state's attorney for Baltimore City for only 3 months when Freddie Gray was arrested. For the next year, she underwent a baptism by fire that opened wide her weaknesses as a leader before she had barely been one. Mosby's election in 2014 had been a made-for-the-movies upset. Mostly unknown on the political landscape, the 35-year-old defeated incumbent Greg Bernstein with a fraction of his campaign dollars and endorsements. Mosby and her husband, Councilman Nick Mosby, shored up enough support from community leaders and ran a charismatic campaign, while Bernstein avoided media attention. Mosby's campaign slogan was, "Our time is now," which sounded like a call to disaffected African Americans. But most of her campaign rhetoric was tough on crime. She criticized the incumbent for letting repeat violent offenders back on the street. For what it's worth, Bernstein had run 4 years earlier on the exact same platform to defeat the incumbent before him. Mosby was not just young, but inexperienced for a state's attorney. She had worked as an assistant state's attorney, or ASA, for 7 years before becoming a private insurance attorney. She had no experience ever prosecuting a murder case or managing a large staff. For 4 years, Bernstein had established a strong relationship with police commanders and the Fraternal Order of Police. Mosby's announcement of charges against 6 officers in only her 3rd month in office spoiled that relationship. Even before that, Commissioner Anthony Batts has said that he warned his officers about her, whatever that means. Batts's mumblings at the first press conference after Freddie Gray died, caught by our team on a hot mic, indicated that he intended to keep information about this case from her, specifically CCTV camera footage. Mosby faced another obstacle inside of her own department, where she took over and led prosecutors with much more experience than her. Mosby got bad press for firing about 6 key prosecutors in her first 3 months. One of these unsuccessfully sued her, claiming discrimination for having supported Bernstein's re-election. Mosby's initial staff turnover wasn't that unusual, though. Bernstein had done similar. But then, within her first year, more than 40 ASAs left the department or were let go. Based on open source data available online, it looks like Mosby lost about 20% of her chief assistant state's attorneys. We've talked to local attorneys about the state's attorney's office, or SAO, under Mosby. Most have clients that depend on their having a good relationship with the department, so they refuse to speak on the record. But the stories are consistent. SAO is disorganized and ineffective, they say. It is run by inexperienced middle managers, many of them new faces. Prosecutors no longer have discretion as to what cases and penalties to pursue, which felonies can be knocked down to misdemeanors, or when to take plea deals. They must now rely on rubrics and committee decisions. Mosby supporters point to her community-oriented programs for youth and first-time offenders, but even progressive attorneys say that her leadership doesn't do a good job of giving second chances or fighting crime. Only one former SAO staffer was willing to speak on the record. Kinji Scott worked as a community liaison in her office and had been her friend and supporter.
Marilyn Mosby has a lot of bad advisors.
Okay.
Even within the community, she's not bad. It's just the people that's around her. She has, you know, she has some very, very, very bad. Outside of Jan Blesso is the best thing she got up there at the top. Jan Blesso is the best thing she got. And but the rest of them is tomfoolery. Even with the community engagement efforts, she has a lot of people around her who don't know what the hell they're doing. You got ASAs will not tell you that they need a witness until the day before. They don't know what they're doing. You know, we're supposed to be contacting homicide victims early on to the families of homicide victims early on to establish relationships and rapport with those families. That shit we're not doing. And we should be doing it because, again, that's a part of community engagement.
Scott was fired by Mosby for speaking out about the homicide rate on social media, he says. For a chief prosecutor facing negative press on a nearly weekly basis, Mosby is understandably conscious of optics. Her office got terrible press throughout the Freddie Gray trials, almost the first 2 years of her administration. It didn't start off badly for her. Her announcement of charges was a national media sensation. But the speech itself, laying out her entire case, might have been her first major mistake.
Mr. Gray was then placed in a prone position with his arms handcuffed behind his back. It was at this time that Mr. Gray indicated that he could not breathe and requested an inhaler to no avail. Officers Miller and Narrow then placed Mr. Gray in a seated position and subsequently found a knife clipped to the inside of his pants pocket. The blade of the knife was folded into the handle. The knife was not a switchblade and is lawful under Maryland law.
In the Netflix documentary, Making a Murderer, Prosecutor Ken Kratz gave press conferences during which he made serious claims against Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. Kratz received criticism for exploiting media. He had only been 4 months into the case. The defense team asked the judge to dismiss the charges based on inflammatory and highly prejudicial pretrial publicity. Yet, here is Marilyn Mosby, only 3 weeks into the Freddie Gray investigation, similarly laying out her entire case, based on an investigation that even her office said that day was inadequate. It would have taken an extreme amount of political will to admit that her one major moment in the spotlight was flawed. Mosby is most likely running for re-election in 2018. She still has a block of influential supporters in the city, but she may not be quite the beacon of hope she once was. Since Freddie Gray, Mosby has not continued to pursue police brutality as an issue.
We have these community day and court events where we deal with different topics. But one topic that the office has said, the front office or Maryland office has said, says that we can do nothing on police brutality after what happened with the Freddie Gray situation. So we don't discuss issues of police brutality, of police misconduct in the community at all.
So what happened? Did Mosby lose her spine? Because I saw those cops shoot the guy with two knives, and I thought, well, that's even clearer than the footage we have on Freddie Gray. Why, you know?
I know, right? You see what I'm saying? And you see she said absolutely nothing about that.
That's nothing. A shame.
That's a shame. And nobody's talking about it either.
Mosby oversaw the Freddie Gray case from a distance. Two of her top personnel, Chief Deputy Michael Schatzow and Deputy Janice Bledsoe, were put in charge of the case and argued it in court. Consider this for a moment. Schatzow is Mosby's number two. He oversees Bledsoe and two other deputy SAs. Bledsoe oversees six divisions. The department handles from 30 to 50,000 cases a year. Mosby is the political face of the department. Presumably, her deputies handle day-to-day management. How easy could it have been for them to divide their attention between six incredibly high-profile trials and their new massive leadership positions. Both Bledsoe and Schatzow came from private practice, but had served as prosecutors at one time. Neither had handled homicide cases, at least not as reported. Schatzow had worked largely in federal fraud prosecutions. Bledsoe had been the police integrity prosecutor under Bernstein for a couple of years, so both had some relevant experience, but a homicide prosecution is another animal. It has a victim who can't speak. Why would Mosby dedicate her top personnel to these cases when she had a whole homicide division filled with experienced prosecutors with no other administrative responsibilities? Lisa Goldberg was one of these. She had 25 years of experience at SAO. She was assigned to the case, but not to lead it. Janice Bledsoe was the lead prosecutor. She's an interesting person, a bit hard to pin down. One former ASA said, "People think she just hates cops." She was fired by Bernstein when she pursued a case against one of his friends, a police officer. WBAL-TV investigated and reported on this case, exposing internal emails from Bernstein. These reports helped Mosby's campaign. WBAL's lead investigative reporter is Jane Miller, Bledsoe's then-partner, now her wife. It's not hard to see why some people in Baltimore consider this relationship to be politically powerful. Not everyone agrees that Bledsoe is anti-cop. In her role as police integrity prosecutor, she largely was involved in serving as a liaison to defense attorneys who wanted to see internal affairs files. Attorneys have told me that Bledsoe could be protective of officers' files, defensive of cops known to be trouble. Union rules and judges' decisions greatly limit what defendants could see anyway. Also, as a private defense attorney, Bledsoe once successfully represented an officer who was charged with several rapes. Overall, Bledsoe's complicated relationship with police is evident throughout the Freddie Gray case. She takes them on, but not entirely. Her case depends on them as witnesses. Bledsoe and Schatzow are respected as trial attorneys. Both have careers marked by very important cases. But even their supporters could see the major flaws in the cases they put forward here.
I love summertime, and for me, it's when I have lots of friends and family come visit. So I like being able to cook something fresh and interesting for them. That's why I love Blue Apron. You know Blue Apron. It's the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. They send you the best products from more than 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers right to your door. It's a great way to make sure that you're getting seafood sourced sustainably, beef, chicken, and pork raised in the most responsible ways possible, and produce from farms committed to regenerative farming, and you don't have to worry about food waste because you only receive what you need. So for less than $10 a meal, you can serve up dishes to all your guests. Your vegetarian friends are in town? Whip up elote-style vegetable tostadas with summer squash, poblano peppers, and cilantro rice, or the spiced zucchini enchiladas with creamy lime and tomato rice. How about your cousin who's off red meat? Whip up a warm, smoked trout and asparagus salad with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons. And if you want to impress your in-laws from the South, whip up the peach honey glazed chicken with mashed sweet potatoes, collard greens, and Thai basil. Each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card and can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/undisclosed. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/undisclosed. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
In
late June 2015, it was announced that Judge Barry Williams would preside over the trials of the six officers charged in Freddie Gray's death. Judge Williams, who is African American, has sat on the bench since 2005 and was named the head of the Baltimore City Circuit Court's Criminal Division in 2011. But before that, Williams had been a Baltimore Assistant State's Attorney for 8 years before going to work as a trial attorney in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice in 1997. There, many media outlets reported, Williams investigated and prosecuted police misconduct cases, including one Washington, D.C. officer 3 times. The news that Williams would oversee the trials in this case was mostly well received. Quote, "You couldn't ask for a more fair-minded judge," said Billy Murphy, the Baltimore civil rights attorney who represents Freddie Gray's family. Most believed that his relevant experience gave Williams an advantage when it came to understanding what qualified as legal versus illegal behavior for police officers. This could be viewed as posing a disadvantage to the state, however. The DOJ's standards of prosecution are higher than they are at the state level, so Williams wouldn't necessarily be easily persuaded. At the federal level, cases can take months or years to build. Mosby brought charges against the six officers after just 2 weeks. The burden of proof was on the state, and Bledsoe and Schatzow would have to bring their A game. And not just once, but 6 times. That's because on a very busy day in early September 2015, Williams denied defense motions to dismiss the charges against the officers and to recuse Marilyn Mosby, but he also ruled that the officers should be tried separately in the interests of justice. The defendants were each facing a range of charges, some more serious than others, and the evidence for one case wouldn't necessarily be admissible in another. Whether Williams would be able to maintain his own impartiality across all of the trials led some to question whether the state or defense would, at some point, ask the judge to recuse himself. They didn't, by the way. In the courtroom, when court was in session, Judge Williams had a mostly no-nonsense, don't-bullshit-me attitude. He was not easily impressed or amused, but he also was charming when he deigned to be, usually when addressing the courtroom rather than the participants. But he didn't hesitate to remind the crowd whose house they were in. When someone's cell phone dared to ring during one of the trials, Judge Williams dragged all the ladies and gentlemen of the courtroom for daring to interrupt his proceedings. I really wanted to make this read my ringtone, but I was worried I'd be sued for broadcasting trial audio. On some days, Williams had a friendly rapport with the attorneys, but was mostly all business, even when Nero, Goodson, and Rice elected bench trials, making him the sole decider of fact. During all 3 trials, Williams also continued to enforce strict rules for the media and always turned on the white noise during bench conferences. These are always secret during jury trials, but when there's no jury, everyone, including the judge, tends to speak a little more freely in open court, and they usually aren't as insistent upon whispering when the attorneys do approach the bench. Many of the bench conferences in this case remained under seal until after Mosby dropped charges, and some of them still are. The bench conferences that are on the trial audio reveal Williams' softer side. He had a much more cordial relationship with all the attorneys than it necessarily appeared when court was in session. With the white noise on, Williams seemed less annoyed, more relaxed about whatever issue had brought the attorneys to his desk in the first place. But by the Rice trial, for sure, Williams was bored. I'll leave the legal analysis to our resident attorney, but I felt like Williams was disappointed with the state's case. Like, really disappointed. Disappointed in almost a sort of disgusted way, like he was sucking his teeth the entire time he was writing his acquittal decisions. I wonder about those still-sealed bench conferences and what they might contain. During the state's closing rebuttal at the trial of van driver Officer Caesar Goodson, Williams actually interrupted the prosecution to ask for proof of their claim that Goodson had given Freddie Gray a rough ride, the basis for their second-degree depraved heart murder charge. Quote, "The state said to the world it was a rough ride," said Judge Williams. "Where's your evidence?" By that point in the Goodson trial, Williams was already super salty with the state for committing a Brady violation with that undisclosed proffer meeting with Dante Allen. The fact that they played dumb about it seemed to piss him off more, though. Williams appeared almost insulted that Schatzow and Bledsoe would argue that the meeting with Allen wasn't, quote, classic exculpatory information. He continued, quote, "If your office doesn't get that, I don't know where we are at this point, counsel." Early on in our investigation, one of my sources told me that they thought Williams went into the trials favoring the cops. They said that despite what had been reported by the media, Judge Williams' time in the DOJ's Civil Rights Division wasn't quite so sterling. They couldn't provide specific examples, though, and there isn't much available online since the DOJ typically assists local prosecutors and don't appear on most online court records. I heard some whisperings that Williams was familiar with a few of the task force investigators because he was a go-to judge for signatures on search and arrest warrants. But you could say the same thing about a number of other judges, too. It's important to note that Judge Williams ruled in the state's favor plenty of times, including denying every defense request to dismiss the charges. He gave the state every last possible chance to meet his standards for proving the charges they chose. His verdicts to acquit were clear about how and where they failed. Whether his burden of proof was too high, well, we'll get to that.
The case against the officers charged in Freddie Gray's death played out in four trials, but it played out even more in pretrial motions, many of them more exciting than what was happening in court. Take the knife. It wasn't mentioned once in court, but in the motions, it's a topic of heated and suspenseful debate. The prosecution planned to call a knife expert to prove its legality. The defense subpoenaed the entire SAO charging division to prove that the prosecution was still charging people for this very type of knife, legal or not. The prosecution requested knife sales records from the officers. Was this to prove that the cops were familiar with this type of knife, or to prove that one of them had planted it? The defense said that the prosecution was looking into charging Miller with perjury over what he wrote in the charging documents. This is all a lot of very exciting story about the knife. But then, just before Nero's trial, the defense filed a motion to preclude mention of the knife in court, and the prosecution didn't fight it. They had shifted their case around the arrest to an improper Terry stop, or pre-arrest detention, which happened before the knife was discovered. So instead of discussions about the knife's legality and chain of evidence in court, which would have been amazing in my opinion, we heard from training academy instructors about how long a Terry stop should be and what it should comprise. This argument didn't exactly soar. Terry stop guidelines aren't solid, and they allow for officer discretion. There was a huge number of motions in this case, nearly 400 among the six trials, including responses and responses to responses. To get a sense of scale, I looked up how many motions were filed in other well-known cases, O.J. Simpson, Martha Stewart, Scott Peterson. I also looked at some local cases. Usually, there was only a handful of motions from either side. One exception was in the Rodney King case. That defense filed 30 motions right away. It might be a police thing. The defense in this case was especially aggressive. They filed a motion to move the trials out of Baltimore, wrote a response to the state's response to that motion, and then, when this was rejected, resubmitted the request based on one Baltimore Sun headline that very slightly favored the state. The defense sought to dismiss charges several times based on a number of things: prosecutorial misconduct, failure to charge for a crime, and so on. At one point, they claimed that Mosby was a witness to the case. They attached a memo from her office, which went to the Western District Patrol leadership, that requested enhanced drug enforcement on Mount Street and West North Avenue. That's exactly where Lieutenant Rice encountered Gray. The press picked up on this. The Baltimore Sun's headline was, "Baltimore prosecutor asked police to target area where Freddie Gray was arrested." These motions to dismiss were unsuccessful, but they did allow information to get into the press. As the state wrote in its response, "This email exchange," meaning the memo from Mosby, "somehow meant that certain of the defendants were acting at the direction of the state's attorney the day they are alleged to have arrested Mr. Gray. Once more, the defendants have used a public pleading not to raise a legitimate dispute for this court's resolution, but to offer the media additional fodder to drive the defendants' narrative." In October, Judge Williams finally granted the state a gag order. By then, media was flooded with stories that made Freddie Gray's death seem like his fault, and the state's attorney's office looked terrible. The defense had one repeated attack against SAO that was more successful. They accused the state of discovery violations. SAO was supposed to turn over all of its exculpatory materials, or evidence that might have supported the defense's case, by June. In September, they were continuing to hand over materials, including cell phone records, training materials, and more. Supreme Court decision Brady versus Maryland requires that prosecutors turn over all exculpatory materials. The defense demanded sanctions and that materials be turned over immediately. SAO said that they had turned everything over as soon as they received it. The defense continued to claim otherwise. A year later, during Goodson's trial, the defense issued a motion to dismiss based on discovery violations. The state was still withholding evidence, they said, including that meeting with Dante Allen. Judge Williams told prosecutor Michael Schatzo, "I'm not saying you did anything nefarious. I'm saying you don't understand what exculpatory means." Some of what the state was being asked to hand over does seem to have been created by police for the defense. Detective Danielle Taylor, the lead investigator, created a video of the knife which the defense claimed proved it was a switchblade. It didn't. It wasn't a switchblade. SAO was sanctioned for not turning over this, as well as 4 months of Detective Taylor's notes. In these notes, she said that she heard Dr. Carol Allen, the medical examiner, say that Freddie Gray's death was an accident. Dr. Allen denied saying this, and no other detective reported it in their notes. Even Taylor didn't write it in her official progress notes. These were just some other notes she wrote. On the stand, Schatzo went after Taylor for writing her notes way after the fact and backdating them. She denied this. Taylor's possibly backdated notes were reported on by Fox 45's Joy LaPola Stewart and the Baltimore Sun's Justin Fenton. Both claimed to have, quote, verified their authenticity. Meaning what? They could tell they weren't backdated? That's the implication, and that hands that argument to the defense. I asked both reporters what they meant by authenticated. They declined to answer. Taylor's knife video, her notes, and more, it might have been manipulated to help the defense. The defense probably already saw them. This put SAO in a ridiculous bind to have to disclose them, introducing them to court and media. Unfortunately, when it comes to Brady law, the state has an obligation to go through the formality of turning exculpatory materials over, however suspicious in origin. And they didn't always do that. At one point, the state even had to turn over text messages between Detective Taylor and Prosecutor Janice Bledsoe, which Taylor had introduced as evidence. They were designed to show that Bledsoe was uninterested in Taylor's discoveries. But what they really show is an intensely passive-aggressive relationship between the prosecutors and police investigators. From the beginning, it's clear that Taylor did not believe in the charges. She said in one text, "I did not feel comfortable reading that script about her grand jury testimony. Between us, I believe we omitted key things from their combined statements." Bledsoe responded, "Understood, and you skipped some parts." At one point, Taylor made a request to Bledsoe for medical and disciplinary records for Freddie Gray. Bledsoe asked why. Taylor said, "I just received information about an incident in the jail we need to investigate further. It came from an anonymous tip, a female caller, who said that Gray often feigned injury." She pushed Bledsoe to consider this, but Bledsoe kept saying, "We have to discuss," and not following up. It's not hard to read between the lines here. Bledsoe knew her investigator was trying to disprove her case, but prosecutors have obligation when it comes to information, however dubious. Bledsoe was blocking Taylor's agenda, and vice versa. Taylor was not helpful in getting warrant applications approved for the officers' personal cell phones and email records. She drafted probable cause statements that were too general and sent the application including the wrong jurisdiction. Those phone records could have been enormously helpful in piecing together what happened on the 12th. Then again, Bledsoe did not seem to be overseeing the applications closely and waited until late May to pursue the records. This tense, passive-aggressive relationship eventually dissolved into Bledsoe asking, "Why are you so angry all the time?" And Taylor saying, "What in the world did I do to you today?" And Taylor wondering why Bledsoe tried to have her removed from the case, and Bledsoe insisting that she never did that. someone from the state's attorney's office did request that Taylor be removed, although maybe not right then. Schatzow brought this up when he questioned Taylor on the stand, in one of the juicier moments from all four trials. Here's how this went down. Schatzow: Detective Taylor, you're aware that you were removed from being the lead detective on this investigation at my request when I accused you of sabotaging the prosecution. Taylor: I'm aware that you made a request, but you don't have the authority to remove me from the case. Schatzow: Right, but you were removed, weren't you? Taylor: No, I wasn't. Then Schatzow laughed, dumbfounded. Laughter to which the defense objected. Then he asked if, on or about August 11th, Major Branford of Homicide had requested her removal. Taylor: You requested that. Schatzow: And didn't he tell you that he was honoring my request? Taylor: No, he didn't. Schatzow: So when he wrote me a letter to that effect, that would be inaccurate? He did not honor our request? Taylor: What we determined was that I would cease any contact with your office, but I still managed all of the case files and everything related to the case. I am still the lead investigator. It's not supposed to work like this. This is just one example of why outside agencies should probably handle criminal investigations and prosecutions of police. The state's Brady violations were one problem they faced in court. The bigger problem was that they put forward a case that didn't add up to a cohesive story about Gray's death. Once the motions were resolved, this case came down to 7 arguments. First, police personnel proving that the cops received an email just before Gray's arrest requiring them to seatbelt all passengers. The defense easily showed that most cops probably didn't read the email. Second, medical experts testifying that Gray's type of injury was progressive, so could have happened between stops 2 and 4. The defense called their own experts saying that it was catastrophic, meaning it had to happen after stop 5. Third, crime scene and DNA experts testifying that the blood found in the van belonged to Gray. Only, the state never tied this evidence to the rest of their story, and the defense revealed that there was no proper chain of evidence for the van. Fourth, police experts arguing that a proper Terry stop or pre-arrest detention should be brief and not involve handcuffs. The defense countered that such rules had exemptions. Fifth, eyewitnesses to stop 2, Brandon Ross and Jamel Baker, who, well, they didn't really matter to the state's case. The state argued that Gray was killed between stops 2 and 4. Sixth, a taped interview with William Porter, who suggested that Gray was in some kind of distress at stop 4. Unfortunately, the state also argued that Porter was a liar. And finally, the state's case depended on 2 videos. CCTV footage of a police van making a wide turn through a stop sign. And then security footage, with no time or date, of a van driver, not clearly Goodson, checking in the back. So that was their case. We discussed the strengths of the SAO's case with David Jaros, a local attorney who attended many of the trials.
Look, I think when this case was charged, the prosecution was expecting the evidence to develop in a very different way. Yeah. And if you look at how even the cases were charged, I think the prosecution was expecting or at least hoping that by charging everyone, they would get one of the officers to cooperate with them and they would be able to develop their case in a better way. Unfortunately for them, no more evidence materialized and no officer, not surprisingly, cooperated. And as a result, they sort of were left with charges that they frankly didn't have, I think, the evidence they thought would come out to prove. And so they were left with a theory that started probably as a rough ride or a beating and were left with trying to prove the charges with a theory of a sort of offensive touching based on lacking sort of sustained reasonable suspicion to detain or probable cause to arrest. And they were forced to argue a failure to get medical attention rather than sort of a deliberate rough ride. I think one might question at some point whether or not the prosecution perhaps needed at some point to reevaluate the strength of their case and the charges as the cases developed, because I think they had some really significant legal hurdles, and again, may have set up the public with an expectation that they would be able to prove those charges, when in fact the evidence that was available to offer in court wasn't going to support that kind of those charges.
Not only was the state's case weak, but the prosecutors had issues with their storytelling. Schatzow often got basic facts confused. Bledsoe took extremely long pauses in between questions, losing steam. Her questioning of witnesses, like all of those blood and DNA experts, it was long, detailed, it seemed to be leading somewhere, but it generally had no payoff. Bledsoe and Schatzow are recognized as good trial attorneys, so it's not clear if they were underprepared or trying to make the best of a bad case. At times, Bledsoe seemed to go out of her way to make a faulty police narrative stick together. When Dante Allen couldn't remember really basic details about the van ride during his interview, like whether he was on the right or left side, Bledsoe mentioned that he had been on drugs that day. When Detective Sarita Teal's notes from her first call with William Porter said that stop four happened at Baker and Druid Hill, not, as he would later say, Dolphin and Druid Hill, Bledsoe asked Teal if she sometimes made mistakes. Both stop four and Dante Allen's ride are incredibly suspicious. Bledsoe had to make these inconsistencies work to prove the narrative laid out by Mosby in her initial press conference. Sometimes a more compelling case came through in court. When Bledsoe revealed that Officer Novak had had a separate conversation with Dante Allen before he was formally interviewed and told Allen that his name was Danny, she was hinting at a conspiracy to cover up. When Bledsoe and Schatzow pointed out that the story about Freddie Gray violently shaking the van at stop two after he was loaded back in wasn't supported by video, they suggested that the conspiracy started early. Then there's this moment that has haunted me from the first time I heard it. In Schatzow's closing to Porter's trial, he talked about how at stop two, Porter said he couldn't tell who was coming out of the van. It was Rice, and he was only about 10 feet in front of him, but Porter acted like he didn't know who it was. Schatzow asked this. What was he trying to cover up? Was he covering up his own knowledge of what had happened there? What happened where, Schatzow? At stop two? Because I thought your theory was that Gray was fine leaving stop two and then injured afterwards. So what would Porter be hiding about stop two? And why the hell didn't you guys make that case instead?
There was a lovely guy who I became friendly with over the course of these trials, and he was outside of the courthouse for every single day. And he had a sign. The sign occasionally changed, but it was essentially, you know, don't let bad cops get away with this. And we got to talking, and so we sat and talked about the elements of the crime. And when we finished going over what exactly the prosecution actually had to prove for each thing, he was like, oh man, like, I don't know what I would do. And I think that's part of the dilemma here, is proving each element beyond a reasonable doubt in these cases was really hard.
Every trial on TV and in the movies has a star witness, someone whose make or break testimony sends murmurs through the courtroom, forcing the judge to pound their gavel and shout, "Order in the court! Order in the court!" Of all the witnesses on the prosecution's list, assistant medical examiner Dr. Carol Allen was, or needed to be, their star. Spoiler alert. Back in episode 11, we reviewed the available medical evidence, learned more about Freddie Gray's jump facet fracture dislocation and spinal cord injury, and shared our medical experts' dubiousness about both the state and defense theories for how that injury occurred. A review of the autopsy, medical testimony, and other evidence, including witness accounts not considered by the state or defense medical experts, led neurosurgeon Dr. Adam Lipson to reach the opinion that it was more likely that Freddie's neck fracture and spinal cord injury occurred when he was thrown headfirst into the van at stop two. But I want you to forget all that for now. Don't worry, though, I'm not going to revisit all the insufficient weak evidence or speculation or really even anything related to Freddie's injury. Instead, we've got to tackle all the other ways the defense was able to discredit and create reasonable doubt around Dr. Allen's autopsy report. First, let's be clear on the definitions of cause and manner of death. Cause of death refers to the disease or injury that initiated the train of morbid events leading directly to death or the circumstances of the accident or violence that produced the injury. Manner of death is how the cause occurred. Was it natural, or did it happen by suicide, homicide, or an accident? If no manner of death can be determined, a medical examiner may rule as such. Dr. Allen's autopsy is clear about Freddie Gray's cause of death, a neck injury, which then led to severe spinal cord damage, which cut off the flow of oxygen to his brain, resulting in ultimately fatal anoxic brain death. As to the manner of death, Dr. Allen quickly ruled out natural causes, as well as suicide. Despite concerted efforts to push the narrative that Freddie injured himself, there was simply no medical evidence to support it. That left Dr. Allen with accident, homicide, and undetermined. Here's what her report concluded. Based on the sequence of events and the described progressive alteration of mental and physical status, Mr. Gray's neck injury occurred while in custody, in and during transport in the police van. Safety equipment was available but not used. Therefore, it was not an unforeseen event, a medico-legal definition of an accident, that a vulnerable individual was injured during operation of the vehicle, and that without prompt medical attention, the injury would prove fatal. Due to the failure of following established safety procedures through acts of omission, the manner of death is best certified as homicide. Acts of omission. To be clear, Dr. Allen was referring to the failure to seatbelt and the failure to get Freddie prompt medical attention. That their outcomes could be foreseen was what made Freddie's death a homicide rather than an accident. But the defendants didn't share equal responsibility for those acts of omission, especially within the state's narrative for how and when the injury occurred. This weakened the state's case against the officers individually, and even neutered their use of Dr. Allen as an expert witness. Prior to the trial of Officer Nero, for example, Judge Williams denied the state's request to detail Freddie's injuries through expert testimony. The specifics of his death weren't as relevant to the second-degree assault and misconduct charges against Nero. Dr. Allen was called to the stand only briefly in order to move the autopsy into evidence. The state relied instead on Joseph McGowan, a bioengineer and accident reconstructionist, to make the case that Freddie's injuries could have been avoided if he had been seatbelted. Like Nero, Lieutenant Brian Rice only interacted with Freddie at stop one and stop two, before Allen believed his injury occurred. But Rice was charged with manslaughter because of his failure to seatbelt as the officer in charge, and so the details of Freddie's fatal injury were relevant and admissible. At Rice's trial, Dr. Allen's testimony more clearly discussed both acts of omission. Rice's defense focused on eliciting that Allen's homicide ruling required both. Can we agree that your opinion is that the failure to use a seatbelt alone, absent the medical aid issue, does not rise this case to the level of a homicide? Is that correct? Defense attorney Michael Belsky asked. That is correct, Allen agreed. Dr. Allen was used more effectively at the Porter and Goodson trials because their narrative held both officers responsible for the failure to seatbelt and to seek immediate medical help. But these, quote, acts of omission were almost entirely discussed in terms of policies and general orders, thanks in part to Dr. Allen's admittance that she Googled to find BPD general orders regarding persons in custody. Porter defense attorney Joseph Murtha was all over that. Are you familiar with the written directives developed by the police department are for internal use only and do not enlarge an officer's civil or criminal liability in any way? He asked. Are you familiar with that? He asked again, after Williams sustained Bledsoe's objection. No, I'm not, Dr. Allen replied. Both Goodson and Porter's defense strategy was to punch a hole through Dr. Allen's contention that Freddie was injured between stops two and four, which the state implied happened as a result of Goodson's rough ride right turn just prior to stop three. Murtha landed a few solid blows on the autopsy's thin narrative. Quote, do you have any facts that you can tell the ladies and gentlemen of the jury about anything that's documented between stops two and four that Freddie Gray moved in any way, any fact, any information at all? He asked. And then, after a quick testy back and forth between Bledsoe and Williams over how she offered her objection, Dr. Allen was allowed to answer. Other than that he was injured, no. We'll be right back. Goodson's defense struck an early victory when Judge Williams ruled that a key part of the autopsy and testimony at Porter's trial wouldn't be allowed into evidence this time. Dr. Allen wrote in her autopsy report that at stop four, Freddie was saying he couldn't breathe. But this didn't come from Porter's statement. It came from Detective Sarita Teal's notes from their phone conversation 2 days earlier. At his own trial, Porter testified that he was referring to stop one when he told Teal that Freddie said, quote, "I can't breathe." Teal testified that she stood behind her interpretation of Porter's comment. Before the autopsy was entered into evidence at the Goodson trial, Williams struck that line from the autopsy report on the basis of it being hearsay, and Teal was also not called to testify again. Dr. Allen, meanwhile, kind of found herself on trial. She not only had to defend herself against Detective Danielle Taylor's claim that she had initially called Freddie's death an accident, but she had to reassess her conclusion on when Freddie was injured, without the alleged "I can't breathe" statement as evidence. Allen maintained that Freddie's lethargic demeanor, his request for help, his need to be helped back onto the bench, all suggest he was already in distress. At the very latest, she conceded, he was definitely injured by stop five. As her testimony went on, Dr. Allen seemed to buckle under the pressure of defense attorney Amy Askew's relentless questions, particularly when it came to the autopsy investigation. Askew suggested that Dr. Allen had rushed to finish the autopsy and with a conclusion of homicide at the behest of the state's attorney's office. While Dr. Allen denied this, she did affirm that she was leaning towards homicide since shortly after she performed the mechanical autopsy on April 20th. With question after question, Askew got Allen to reveal just how much evidence she had yet to receive at that point. She didn't have statements from the officers or the EMTs. She hadn't inspected a van, let alone the van, and she hadn't seen the blood evidence. But Dr. Allen testified that by April 21st, she had already considered and ruled out three out of the five available choices for manner of death: natural, suicide, and accident, contrary to what Detective Taylor in her notes had to say. Quote, "Between the 21st and the 23rd, when I met with Dr. Fowler in the morning, I had reviewed the information that I had and I said, this is not an accident," Dr. Allen testified. While she had been given a brief rundown of the circumstances before the autopsy, it's not clear when Allen learned that Freddie hadn't been seatbelted, and she didn't take notes during her initial meetings with detectives. If she didn't yet know about the acts of omission, then something else about Freddie's injury led Dr. Allen to believe it couldn't have been the result of an accident. Askew's line of questioning makes it seem like Dr. Allen's tunnel vision blinded her to just one outcome, an accident, when it actually prevented her from considering additional plausible homicide scenarios. Freddie Gray is the primary victim in this case, no doubt, but he's not alone. Two other young black men became collateral damage as well. Aside from the character witnesses at Officer Porter's trial, just three civilians took the stand to testify: Jamel Baker, Brandon Ross, and Dante Allen. Jamel Baker was called to testify by the state, and his testimony was limited to specific, carefully chosen details. His recollection of looking out the window and seeing Freddie reloaded into the van was punctuated by the detail that he only recognized that it was his friend because of his shoes. Brand new gray and green New Balances. The only guy in the neighborhood to have them. Jamel was a witness the state could depend on. He didn't have a criminal record, and he was a responsible, employed single father. Brandon Ross and Dante Allen are kind of another story. Brandon Ross, Freddie's best friend, was with Freddie that morning. He witnessed the start of the foot chase and was present at both stop one and stop two. He took video at the latter and gave a detailed statement to police just one day later. But very few of those details came out when he testified. He was never asked questions that would have solicited those answers. Certainly not by the defense, but not by prosecutors who put him on their witness list for all four trials. And on three of those occasions, he was handcuffed and shackled, a prisoner himself. Like Jamel Baker, the state used Brandon as an inroad to introducing a few carefully chosen details. Why Freddie took off running that morning. Officer Porter's disregard for Brandon's request for a supervisor. And Lieutenant Rice's threats if the crowd at Gilmore Homes didn't disperse. Brandon's testimony was also used to enter two cell phone videos into evidence. The video shot by Kevin Moore at stop one, and the footage Brandon took at stop two. Brandon had to watch both pieces of footage play in open court over and over again, sometimes with audio, sometimes without, in front of the very officers whose indifference he had been unable to penetrate. Brandon was a free man when he was called as a witness at the trial of William Porter. His testimony was gut-wrenching. Freddie was his friend for more than 10 years. "We were like brothers," he said quietly, and he often had to be reminded to speak up. When the videos were played, Freddie's mother, who was sitting in the courtroom, began sobbing, and Brandon also became very emotional and started to cry. This prompted Judge Williams to call a brief recess. When court resumed, the defense made a stink about the fact that State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby, who was present in court that day, had been seen speaking with Brandon during the break, which they found to be inappropriate. Prosecutors Bledsoe and Schatzow assured the judge that she was simply telling Brandon he was doing a good job. God forbid anyone regard him as someone in need and deserving of a little comfort. It almost seemed like Brandon's emotions were viewed as a potential liability going forward. On March 16, 2016, a few months before the Nero trial, Brandon Ross was arrested on a long list of assault charges for a March 15th incident in which police said Brandon stabbed a man during a fight near Gilmore Homes. Brandon was denied bail and held in the Baltimore City Jail to await trial, which was repeatedly postponed. He was allowed to leave the jail on three occasions, though, to testify against officers Nero, Goodson, and Rice, each time in handcuffs, shackles, and a prison-issued jumpsuit. At a bench conference during the Nero trial, Prosecutor Janice Bledsoe asked that Brandon be brought into the courtroom without shackles and handcuffs. Judge Williams wouldn't allow it. Quote, "Hey, you guys arrested him," Williams said when Bledsoe protested, hedging, "Well, not you." "Not me personally," Bledsoe replied. "If it was me personally, he wouldn't be in jail." And then everyone briefly kind of chuckled before returning to their seats. I'll come back to that in a minute. Anyway, while Porter's attorney, Gary Proctor, had been respectful of Brandon during his cross-examination, the same cannot be said of Nero's attorney, Mark Zayon. Zayon, from the moment he opened his mouth, was contemptuous, snide, and condescending. Here's one exchange I found particularly stomach-churning. "It's fair to say there is drug selling in the Gilmore homes," Zayon asked Brandon. "Where are drugs not being sold in Baltimore City?" Ross responded. "Good answer. So the answer is yes, then?" Zayon said, and then he continued, "There's crime in the Gilmore homes, correct?" "There's crime in the whole world," Brandon said, nodding correctly. "Oh, okay. And you've been to the whole world?" Zayon replied. "Of course Brandon hasn't seen the whole world, Zayon. It's very possible he's never even left Baltimore. Do you feel superior now?" Zayon's mocking tone earned an immediate scolding from Judge Williams, who struck the question and ordered Zayon not to do it again. Anyway, back to those charges Brandon was facing. I had been suspicious that something wasn't right since well before I ever heard that squeaky exchange between Bledsoe and Williams. A few weeks after Mosby dropped the remaining charges against the officers, prosecutors suddenly tossed out their case against Brandon. I was reminded of that housing authority eviction case Freddie was indirectly connected to, the one in which his co-defendant was a witness and the drug charges weren't dropped until the case was resolved. Was this what happened with Brandon? On one of my trips to Baltimore, I looked at the case file and then watched the hearing where the charges were dropped. First of all, the state's attorney's case was not much of a case at all. No weapon had been recovered, and the nearby CCTV camera had only captured a group of people gathered outside, but not any sort of altercation, let alone a stabbing. The probable cause statement relies entirely on a confusing account given by the victim's girlfriend. How she came to identify Brandon and two others as the perpetrators is strangely described, but it doesn't appear like she actually saw the assault. A private investigator hired by Brandon's defense attorney tracked down the victim, who the police had never interviewed. He described his attacker as being around 5'8 and 220 pounds, kind of fat, he said, a far cry from Brandon's 6'1 and 160 pound frame. Not only that, but the victim said that he didn't think his girlfriend was even present during the stabbing. A month after Brandon was arrested, his attorney, Lawrence Rosenberg, filed a motion to suppress based on violations of the rules of procedure. Specifically, it appears, procedures involving witness identification and seizing of evidence. He said the pretrial identification process was impermissibly suggestive and referred to defects in the institution of the prosecution and in the charging documents. On August 16, 2016, after multiple delays, Brandon was finally brought in front of Judge Charles Peters of the Circuit Court. Assistant State's Attorney Aaron Valenti, who I should note is no longer working for Mosby's office, requested another postponement, saying the victim was, quote, not being cooperative, and the other witness, you know, the victim's girlfriend, had moved, and the detective on the case, quote, didn't know where to find her. Judge Peters denied the request, so Valenti shrugged her shoulders and agreed to null pros all the charges. And that was that. Brandon had been in jail for 5 months. I was able to get Rosenberg on the phone a few months ago, and he told me he couldn't understand why the state was pursuing this particular case when the victim didn't even identify Brandon as his attacker. He said he was aware that the state's attorney was meeting with his client in the days leading up to the officer's trials. They always let him know. But he wasn't made privy to any connection between Brandon's testimony as a witness and his status as a defendant. But he also thought it was interesting that the case was dropped so soon after Mosby ended her prosecution of the Baltimore Six. I'm not suggesting that the state's attorney's office had Brandon Ross arrested on bogus charges. BPD's track record on that speaks for itself. But I do think, whether they'd admit to it or not, that Bledsoe and Schatzow enjoyed the benefits of having direct access to one of their key witnesses, someone who didn't always have a working phone number and isn't the easiest person to get a hold of. With Brandon in custody, there was no fear that he wouldn't show up to court on time, or at all. That his own freedom was at stake was really only further incentive for Brandon to play by the state's rules. We're still trying to figure out exactly what role Dante Allen played on April 12, 2015. We know he gave a statement to homicide detectives about being in the same transport van as a guy who was banging his head after allegedly being arrested up on North Avenue at Stop 5. There's a lot that's fishy about this, beyond just our doubts about the banging Dante has supposedly heard, and we'll reveal a little more about that in next week's episode. But one thing I can say for certain is that however Dante Allen found himself wrapped up in this case, it set off a chain of events that he will likely never be able to come back from. It's fair to say that Allen was initially willing to play ball and exchange numbers with Officer Danny, aka Officer Novak, and give a statement to detectives because he didn't want to go to jail himself. Quote, "We had an agreement that he would let me go if I took his number," Allen told prosecutor Janice Bledsoe at the Goodson trial. On probation, Allen had 17 years hanging over his head due to a prior armed robbery conviction. Even a petty charge for possession of marijuana and a few Suboxone strips would be a violation that could send him back to prison for a long time. Who can blame him for looking out for himself? Sure enough, he was let go without a charge, and while he allegedly exchanged a few cordial texts with Danny over the course of the next week, it doesn't sound like he gave up any info about recent crime in the neighborhood. But once Allen backtracked on the statement he gave to detectives Michael Boyd and Joseph Peremski and told the media that the police were lying, well, not only was he no longer cooperating, but he was definitely a liability for the officers once Mosby brought charges. In early May 2015, Allen met with prosecutors not once, but twice. A closer look at Allen's case records in the months after April 12th have led me to wonder if efforts were taken to prevent him from turning into an asset for the state. On July 13th, 2015, in York, Pennsylvania, which is not far from Baltimore, a criminal complaint was filed against Dante Allen for forging a check. Fast forward a month and a half to August 29th, when Allen got a citation from an MTA cop for failure to exhibit payment. Now, according to the York County court records, as of late August, Allen still hadn't been to court. It wasn't like he missed a hearing, though. One just hadn't been set yet. But he must not have been allowed to leave Pennsylvania, because on the same day as the MTA citation, a fugitive warrant was filed by Officer Susan Thomas of Baltimore Police, not York County. To be clear, there's nothing in Allen's Pennsylvania court records indicating they knew he had left the state at that point. And remember, he hadn't missed a court date either. Maybe something came up when the MTA cop ran his name? That seems weird to me, though. According to Case Search, the citation wasn't even added to the system until almost a month later. Would a ticket really initiate a fugitive warrant applying to charges in another state in just a few hours? Dante Allen was arrested the next day. On September 2nd, York County filed their own fugitive declaration, and by September 4th, he was in their custody and unable to post the $20,000 bail. While he was in jail in Pennsylvania, a couple key things happened. First, the judge on Dante Allen's 2012 armed robbery case issued a warrant for violating probation. A few weeks later, Officer William Porter's defense attorney, Joseph Murtha, filed a motion to subpoena Dante Allen, which Judge Williams granted. York County would need to make him available to testify at the trial in December, should the defense decide to call him. It's not clear to me, though, whether Dante Allen was actually brought back to Baltimore. But regardless, Porter's defense decided not to call him to testify. Less than 2 weeks later, a few days before Christmas, Allen agreed to a plea deal in the forgery case and was sentenced to time served plus 3 years probation. In mid-January 2016, not long after he was released, another arrest warrant was issued for Dante Allen, this time for failing to register as a gun offender. The incident date, which I'm guessing would be the deadline, was July 31st, 2015, a whole 6 months earlier. Allen was served with that warrant and the violation of probation warrant in mid-February. So the case files for the gun offender charge say that the judge postponed a scheduled hearing in April so that a global plea agreement for the probation violation could be worked out as well. On May 2nd, a global plea agreement was reached, but the hearing footage indicates not everybody had been informed. After Assistant State's Attorney Jennifer Hastings, who was assigned to the case, told the judge that she was not consulted about the global plea agreement, Allen's attorney, public defender Brenda Holly, said that she spoke with Hastings' colleague about it the week prior. Judge Vedetta Brown took a break so that Hastings could check in with whoever this mysterious colleague was. When court resumed, Hastings was on board with the global plea. The gun registration charge was thrown out, and after Dante Allen pled for leniency, he was sentenced to 10 years for violating his probation with the forgery conviction in Pennsylvania. But Judge Brown also said that at some point, his attorney could file a motion to modify that sentence, provided he behaved himself in prison. 2 days later, on May 4th, 2016, prosecutors met with Allen at the Baltimore City Jail and obtained additional information from him about his arrest on April 12th, which they disclosed immediately to Nero's defense team. Nero, remember, is the one who arrested Allen up on North Avenue and filled out the police report. In mid-May, Nero's lawyers filed a motion to preclude the introduction of other crimes evidence, and the state's response to that motion reveals just what they intended to argue, that Nero had illegally detained, illegally searched, and then failed to seatbelt Dante Allen just as he had with Freddie Gray. Both of these motions were immediately sealed, and ultimately Dante Allen wasn't called to testify at the Nero trial. Goodson's defense did call him to testify, though, but he basically refused to answer their questions. He was much nicer to Bledsoe on cross. The forgery case in Pennsylvania was probably going to bite Dante Allen in the butt either way, but it's hard not to wonder if a fugitive warrant was filed so quickly because BPD saw an opportunity to squirrel him away in the custody of another state. And I wonder the same thing about the gun registration charge that was filed 6 months late. Out of jail and back in Baltimore, with another trial approaching, Dante Allen was a potential liability to both sides if left to his own free will. He could never be the witness Brandon Ross was, though. He changed his story too many times to be a great help to anyone. A few months ago, a new case was added to Dante Allen's case search records. That's weird. Maybe he got caught with contraband? Yeah, not quite. In October 2016, Dante Allen was hit with three assault charges for an incident at the Baltimore City Jail in March 2016. A second inmate was also charged, but with attempted first-degree murder. When their cases were transferred to circuit court in December, they were merged, and Dante Allen was now charged with six counts as well, including attempted first-degree murder. According to the charging documents, Allen and his co-defendant were accused of nearly beating another inmate to death, and the incident was caught by the jail's surveillance cameras. According to those charging documents, the video showed Allen's co-defendant committing most of the assault, but Dante Allen orchestrated it and threw the first punch. There is no explanation for why it took nearly 7 months for charges to be filed. Earlier this month, the cases against both men were resolved. Each was offered a plea deal by the state to a single assault charge, second-degree assault for Allen and first-degree assault for his co-defendant. Allen took the deal and was sentenced to an extra 18 months in prison. His co-defendant rejected his deal and went to trial, which ended with a hung jury. The state's attorney's office decided to drop the charges rather than retry him. A source familiar with the case said that the prosecution's case was weak. Despite the long delay, a thorough investigation into the assault had not been done. Other inmates weren't interviewed, neither were correctional officers, and a trio of law enforcement officers who didn't even work for the jail identified Allen and his co-defendant based only on stills from three of the surveillance camera's footage. That footage failed to convince the jury at the co-defendant's trial. On top of that, the victim declined to file charges on his own, in part because he was unable to identify his own attackers, so he wasn't even called as a witness. The bigger question for me is why no one from the jail stepped in to stop the assault. It went on for 15 minutes in full view of surveillance cameras. Isn't there someone monitoring those cameras? And, you know, the inmates? And if not, how long did it take before the jail learned of the assault and Allen's alleged involvement? Was Dante Allen considered a suspect in the inmate's near murder back in May 2016 when he met with prosecutors? What about in June when he testified for the defense at the Goodson trial? And if not, what prompted the sudden charges in October? Maybe this case is making me paranoid, but something feels off to me. Late September is when our investigation really started to ramp up, and we were making inquiries to various local agencies, including about Dante Allen. As I was going back through my research for this episode, for example, I found an email I sent in late September to the Communications Department at the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. I'd totally forgotten about it. I was inquiring about arranging an interview or otherwise getting in touch with an inmate at the Roxbury Correctional Institution in Hagerstown for a podcast about Freddie Gray. The inmate's name was Dante Allen. "Any help you can provide would be much appreciated," I wrote. Allen and his co-defendant were charged just 2 weeks later.
The very first officer to go to trial in the death of Freddie Gray was Porter, who was charged with involuntary manslaughter, second-degree assault, reckless endangerment, and misconduct in office. The jury deliberated for 3 days, which is not an insignificant amount of time, before they informed the judge that they were deadlocked. The following day, December 16, 2015, Judge Barry Williams declared a mistrial. It's not difficult to understand why the jury was unable to find Porter guilty of any charges. On manslaughter, the judge instructed them that they had to find that what Porter did was, quote, a gross departure from what a, quote, reasonable officer would have done in a similar situation. And to find him guilty of misconduct, they'd also have to find that he acted with, quote, an evil motive and in bad faith. Now, Porter defended himself by arguing he didn't know how serious Freddie Gray's condition was, and that he acted as per protocol by informing both the driver and a supervisor that a medic was needed. I would argue his act of alerting two other officers about Freddie's need for a medic were pretty strong evidence about a lack of bad faith and evil intent. So what really hung the jury up was whether his failure to seatbelt Freddie was unreasonable, and since they couldn't come to a unanimous decision, the judge called it all off. Now, a mistrial doesn't mean the defendant's off the hook, though. It simply means there'll be another trial, another chance for a jury to come to a unanimous decision. But a deadlocked jury was certainly good news for the rest of the defendants who were preparing for their trials, especially Goodson, who was facing the harshest penalty and who was going to be tried the following month. Instead, Nero went to trial next. Now, if there was ever a moment that impacted the fates of the rest of the officers charged as they faced criminal proceedings, it was the moment that Officer Edward Nero and his lawyers decided to go with a bench trial instead of a jury trial. Nero, if you recall, was charged with second-degree assault, manslaughter, false imprisonment, and misconduct in office. Once again, the same circuit court judge, Barry Williams, acquitted Nero of all charges, which led to Officers Goodson and Rice also electing bench trials and avoiding a jury. And I would too under these circumstances. Why take a risk with 12 jurors when a judge has ruled in favor of a co-defendant? So here's why Judge Williams was unable to find Nero guilty of anything. As to the assault charge, he found that Nero had no physical contact with Freddie other than walking him to the van after he'd been detained by Miller, who testified that it was indeed him alone who put the cuffs on Freddie. The court found that the contact between Nero and Freddie Gray was legally justifiable. He was simply walking Freddie to the van. As to the misconduct and office charges, the judge found the state failed to prove that Nero, quote, corruptly did an unlawful act. Again, the court found that Nero had nothing to do with Freddie Gray's detention and arrest, so his act of walking Freddie to the van was not unlawful. The judge also addressed the charges of conspiracy leveled by the state against Nero, maintaining he should be found liable as an accomplice to the crimes of the other officers. What crime, though? The judge stated the entire case against Nero was one of negligence, recklessness, and disregard, but not conspiring in a crime. So that was off the table. Also, the judge found that a reasonable officer in Nero's position could have assumed that the other officers, especially his senior Lieutenant Rice, would make sure a detainee was properly secured in the van, and it wasn't his duty to approach other officers to make sure someone had belted Freddie up. The judge found no recklessness, that Nero didn't go out of his way to make sure Freddie was seatbelted, and therefore no criminal liability. Finally, one of the most interesting aspects of Judge Williams' ruling on misconduct vis-a-vis Nero corruptly failing to seatbelt Freddie Gray was this. He meticulously went through all the training and documentation provided to Nero in his capacity as police officer and basically found that, one, the state failed to show among the many training documents, all the Baltimore Police Department training documents and modules, that this duty even existed. And two, if it did, at no time was Nero informed of this duty. Next came the Goodson trial and verdict. rendered on June 23, 2016, Goodson 2 was cleared of all charges by, yes, again, Judge Barry Williams. A good portion of the judge's analysis was based on Porter's testimony about his encounters with Freddie Gray, that he never saw any blood or injury, that Freddie was breathing normally, and that he didn't seem to be in immediate distress. It was the court's rationale that if Porter didn't understand the seriousness of Freddie's condition, he certainly couldn't have told Goodson about it, so the state could not prove that Goodson had sufficient information to know that Freddie was in need of immediate medical attention. He came to the same conclusion based on the medical evidence and testimony, that according to what was presented in court, there were any number of plausible ways Freddie was injured in a way that led to his death. Remember, the state alleged that it was a wide turn that Goodson took, the rough ride that injured Freddie. But the court found no evidence to support that claim, only that it was one of a number of likely scenarios. Ultimately, the court found that the state wasn't able to prove exactly when Freddie was in need of medical treatment and that Goodson should or would have known he was. The state also failed in its argument that Goodson deliberately was trying to injure Freddie. Why would he, reasoned the court? There was no evidence of animosity between them, no evidence presented that they even knew each other, and no evidence, according to the state itself, that Freddie was aggressive, biting, spitting, fighting, or anything else that would prompt Goodson or any other officer to want to hurt him on purpose or retaliate. Now remember, the court had to decide if Goodson committed depraved heart murder, and one of the primary elements of that charge is that the defendant knew the risk to Freddie's life. For more than one reason, the court found Goodson had no reason to know the extent of Freddie's injuries, and his actions simply could not rise to the level of this charge. Two things saved Goodson on all counts: not being able to know how bad the injuries were, and insufficient evidence of how and when Freddie's injuries were caused. About a month later, in July, Judge Williams also ruled in favor of the defense in the case against Lieutenant Rice, not guilty of involuntary manslaughter, misconduct in office, and reckless endangerment. The seminal question for the court was this: did Rice have an affirmative duty to seatbelt Freddie? His answer? Well, maybe. It all depended on what policy was in place at the time, and more importantly, whether Rice was aware of the policy. The judge found that while the new policy requiring seatbelting of transported detainees had actually been emailed to Rice, and the state proved it, they failed to prove that he was informed of the policy change via roll call or that he actually read the email that was sent to him, stating, quote, "There was no policy in place that required officers to open emails daily or weekly." Frankly, a rather absurd finding as far as I'm concerned. After all, wouldn't it fall within Rice's duty to read and understand all policy documents provided to him by the department? I mean, it seems like a perfect case of ignorance of the law not being an excuse. Nonetheless, the judge thought it was weird that the state expected Rice to know about the policy change just because he was a supervisor, which actually sounds pretty reasonable to me. The court also had to consider if that failure to seatbelt rose to the level of gross criminal negligence. In other words, was Rice acting with wanton disregard for human life by not buckling Gray? The judge said no. The state failed to prove Rice would have the requisite training or knowledge of the possibility of injury, though seriously, it's kind of another absurd argument considering people get tickets for not buckling all the time precisely because the police know it's dangerous. And finally, the judge again twisted the knife a bit to the state by reiterating, hey, you haven't even proven how and when Freddie was injured. In case you haven't noticed, one, in order to get a conviction, the state has to prove every single element of a crime, and two, the judge gave a lot of deference to what the defendants didn't know in this case. They didn't know when Freddie was hurt, how badly he was hurt, that there was a new seatbelt policy, that others had not belted him, that not seatbelting people could cause injury, etc., etc. You get the drift. If you think about it, it made the prosecution's job really hard because proving what a person knows or doesn't know isn't easy. It wasn't enough that the officers should have known something, like having gotten emails about it. According to this judge, they had to prove they had actual knowledge of all the things that they were doing wrong. The trend was clear to the state's attorney's office. After these three were acquitted, they dropped the charges against Porter, Miller, and White, reasoning that they would probably be acquitted for the same reasons. And you know what? They were probably right. You You would think after 15 episodes of painstaking investigation, reporting, and analysis, we would be done with the Freddie Gray story. And we thought we were too. But as we mentioned before, floating out there just beyond our reach, there are many more records and documents that we couldn't get a hold of, despite having filed request after request. And then, wouldn't you know it, not long ago, the clouds parted, and a box of documents we'd never seen before arrived on our doorstep. Next time on Undisclosed.
Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 15, was co-produced in part by Justine Barron and Amelia McDonald-Perry. Justine, Amelia, Dr. Marcia Chatlin, and Rabia Chaudhry co-wrote the episode, Methyl Telham produced, and Saad Chaudhry consulted. Our audio was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. Our great sponsors this week were Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans and Blue Apron. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at UndisclosedPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us on Thursdays at 6 p.m. for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins for a discussion about this week's episode. Follow Dee on Twitter at DeeWatkinsWorld. Ask him questions about the episode with the hashtag Freddie Gray or the hashtag UDAddendum. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for the Undisclosed Addendum featuring Dee Watkins. Until then...